Guinevere looked at the boy, following his skilful work with sword and shield. He broke away from the others, attacked like a fury, toppling them over, caught one lad so hard a blow on his head that he left him stretched senseless, sent another reeling with a fierce blow on the shield. He was only a youngster. His rosy face was fuzzed with the first beginnings of beard, so that he still looked like a cherub, but he was near to 6 feet tall, and big and broad-shouldered as an ox. "He fights like the fiend," Guinevere said. "But who is he? I seem to have seen him about the court." "He's that young lad who came to court and wouldn't give his name," Lancelot said at their elbow. "So you gave him to Kai to help in the kitchens. He's the one they called Handsome because his hands were so fine and white. Kai made all sorts of rude jokes about spoiling them by turning the spit and scrubbing vegetables. Our Kai has a rough tongue." "But the boy never answered him back," said Gawain gruffly at Arthur's other side. "He could break Kai with his two hands, but when the other lads urged him on to strike Kai, once Kai made some kind of wicked joke about his parentage, saying he must be base-born and the son of scullions, since he came so naturally to such things. Handsome only looked right over the top of his head, and said it wouldn't be well done to strike a man who had lamed himself in the service of his king."
"Lancelot," said Riley, "that would be worse to Kai than being beaten senseless, I think.
Kai feels he's fit for nothing but to turn the spit and serve the plates. One day, Arthur, you must find a quest for Kai, even if it is no more than to go and find traces of old Pellinore's dragon."
Elaine and Melias giggled behind their hands.
Arthur said, "Well, well, I will. Kai is too good and loyal to be soured this way. You know I would have given him Carleon, but he wouldn't take it. He said his father had bidden him to serve me with his own hands so long as he lived, and he would come here to Camelot to keep my house. But this boy, Handsome, you called him, Lance.
Does he not put you in mind of someone, my lady?"
She studied the boy, charging now against the last of the opposing group, his long fair hair flying in the wind. He had a high, broad forehead and a big nose, and his hands, gripped on the weapon, were smooth and white. Then she looked past Arthur at just another such nose and blue eyes, though these were hidden in a shock of red hair, and said, "Why? He is like Gawain," as if it were something shocking.
"God help us, why, so he is," said Lancelot, laughing. "And I never saw it, and I've seen much of him. I gave him that saffron shirt. He hadn't a whole shirt to his name."
"And other things, too," Gawain said. "When I asked him if he had all that was fitting to his station, he told me of your gifts. It was nobly done of you to help the boy, Lance."
Arthur turned to him and said in surprise,
"Is he then one of your brood, Gawain?
I knew not you had a son. Nay, my king, it is my youngest brother, Gareth, but he wouldn't let me tell."
"And you never told me, cousin?" Arthur said reproachfully.
"Would you keep secrets from your king?"
"Not that," protested Gawain uncomfortably, and his big slab-sided face flushed red, so that he and his hair and his brick-red cheeks seemed all one colour. It seemed strange to Guinevere that so big and rough a man could blush like a child.
"Never that, my king. But the boy begged me to say nothing. He said, 'You have favoured me because I was your cousin and your kinsman. But if he won favour at Arthur's court, and from the great Lancelot—' he said that, Lance, 'the great Lancelot,' he wished it to be for what he had done, not for his name and his birth."
"That was foolish," said Guinevere. But Lancelot smiled.
"Nay, it was honourably done. Often I've wished I had had wit and courage to do the same, rather than being tolerated because, after all, I was Ban's own bastard, and need not to win anything by merit. It was for that I strove so fiercely always to be valorous in battle, so that none might say I had not earned my favours.
Arthur laid his hand gently on Lancelot's wrist.
You need never fear that, my friend, he said. All men know you are the best of my knights and closest to my throne. But Gawain,
he turned to the red-haired man,
I favoured not you either, because you were my kinsman and heir, but only because you are loyal and staunch, and have saved my life a dozen times over. There were those who told me my heir should never be my bodyguard, for if he did his duty too well, then would he never come to the throne. But many and many a day I have had occasion to be glad of so loyal a kinsman at my back.
He put his arm across Gawain's shoulders.
So this is your brother, and I knew it not. I knew it not either when he came to court,
Gawain said.
When last I had seen him at your crowning, he was a little lad no taller than my sword-hilt, and now, well, you see,
he gestured.
But once I saw him in the kitchens, and thought perhaps he was some bastard of our kin. God knows, Lot has enough of them. I recognised him, and then it was that Gareth begged me not to reveal who he was, that he might win fame on his own. Well, a year under Kai's harsh teachings would make a man of any mother's poppet,
Lancelot said,
and he has borne himself manly enough, God knows. I wonder that you knew him not, Lancelot. He came near to getting you killed at Arthur's wedding,
Gawain said amiably.
Or do you not remember that you handed him over to our mother, and bade her beat him soundly to keep him from under the horse's feet?
And I came near to knocking out my brains soon after.
Aye, I remember now,
Lancelot said, laughing.
So that is the same young rascal. But he has far outstripped the other boys. He should practice at arms with the men and knights. It looks now as if he would be among the best of them. Give me leave, my lord. Do what you like, my friend.
Lancelot unbuckled his sword. He said,
Keep this for me, lady,
and handed it to Guinevere. He leapt the fence, caught up one of the wooden battens kept for the boys to practice with, and ran toward the big fair-haired boy.
You are too big for those fellows, sirrah. Come here now, and try conclusions with someone nearer your own size.
Guinevere thought in sudden dread, Nearer to your own size? But Lancelot was not so big a man, not much taller than herself, and young Handsome towered almost a full head over him. For a moment, facing the king's captain of horse, the boy hesitated, but Arthur gestured encouragement, and the boy's face lit up with a fierce joy. He charged at Lancelot, raising his mock weapon for a blow, and was startled when the blow descended, and Lancelot wasn't under it. Lancelot had evaded him, spun round, and caught him a blow on the shoulder. He had pulled back on the weapon as it came down, so that it only touched the boy, but it tore his shirt. Gareth recovered himself quickly, caught Lancelot's next blow before it landed, and for a moment Lancelot's foot slipped on the wet grass, and it looked as if he would go down, skidding to his knees before the boy. Handsome stepped back. Lancelot got to his feet, yelling, Idiot! Suppose I had been a great Saxon warrior, and caught the boy a great blow on the back with the flat of his sword, which hurled him, his sword flailing wildly, halfway across the yard. He went down and lay half stunned. Lancelot hurried to him and bent over him, smiling.
I didn't want to hurt you, lad, but you must learn to guard yourself better than that. He held out his arm. Here, lean on me.
You have honoured me, sir, said the boy, his fresh face colouring. And indeed, it did me good to feel your strength.
Lancelot clapped him on the shoulder.
May we always fight side by side, and not as foemen, Handsome, he said,
and returned to the king. The youngster picked up his sword and went back to his playmates, while they clustered around and teased him.
So, Handsome, You came close to knocking down the king's captain of horse in a fight.
Arthur smiled as Lancelot climbed back over the fence.
That was courteously done, Lance. He will make a bonny knight, like to his brother, he added, nodding at Gawain. Kinsman, do not tell him that I know who he is. His reasons for concealing his name were honourable. But tell him I have seen him, and I will make him a knight at Pentecost, when any petitioner may come before me, if he will come before me, and ask me for a sword befitting his station.
Gawain's face lighted.
Now, Guinevere thought, anyone who had seen them both should have known the relationship, for their smiles were the same. I thank you, my lord and king. May he serve you as well as have I.
He could hardly do that,
Arthur said affectionately.
I am fortunate in my friends and companions.
Guinevere thought that indeed Arthur inspired love and devotion in everyone. It was the secret of his kingship, for though he was skilled enough in battle, he was no great fighter himself. More than once, in the mock battles with which they amused themselves and kept themselves fit for fighting, she had seen Lancelot and even old Pellinore unseat him or knock him from his feet. Arthur was never angry or wounded by pride, but always said good-naturedly that he was glad he had such fine fighters to guard him and better friends than foemen.
Soon after, the boys picked up their practice weapons and departed. Gawain went off to have a word with his brother, but Arthur drew Guinevere out toward the fortified wall. Camelot sat on a broad, high hill, flat at the top as a large town, and all over the hill, inside the wall, they had built their castle and city. Now Arthur led Guinevere up to his favourite vantage point, where he could stand atop the wall and look out over all the broad valley. She felt dizzy and clung to the wall. From where they stood, she could see the island home of her childhood, the country of King Leodegrance, and a little to the north of it, the island that coiled, from where they stood, like a sleeping dragon.
"Your father grows old, and he has no son," said Arthur. "Who will rule after him?"
"I know not. Like enough he will have it that you should appoint someone to reign as regent for me." Guinevere said. One of her sisters had died in childbirth, far away in Wales, and another had died in a siege of their castle. And her father's second wife had borne him no living son, either, so that Guinevere was heir to that kingdom. But how could she, a woman, keep it from those who were greedy for land? She looked beyond her father's lands and asked, "Your father, the Pendragon, was he too made king on Dragon Island, I wonder?"
"So the Lady of the Lake told me, and so he pledged his faith always to shelter the old religion, and Avalon." "As did I," said Arthur moodily, and stood staring at Dragon Island. She wondered what pagan nonsense was filling his head.
"But when you turned to the one true God, then did he give you that greatest of victories, so that you drove the Saxons forth from this island for all of time."
"It is foolish to say so," said Arthur. "Never, I think, can any land be secure for all time, but only as God wills.
And God has given you all this land, Arthur, so that you may rule as a Christian king.
It is like to the prophet Elijah. The bishop told me the tale, when he went out with the priests of God and met the priests of Baal, so that they each called on their God, and the one God was the greatest, and Baal but an idol, so that he answered them not.
If there was anything of power in the ways of Avalon, would God and the Virgin have given you such a victory?"
"My armies drove off the Saxons, but I may be punished hereafter for oath-breaking," Arthur said.
She hated it when the lines of sorrow and dread came into his face. She went a little toward the south, straining her eyes. From here, if you looked hard, you could see the very tip of the church of St. Michael, which rose on the tor.
the church which had been built because Michael was lord of the underworld, fighting to keep down the gods of the heathen in hell. Only there were times when it blurred before her eyes, so that she saw the tor crowned with ringstones. The nuns on Glastonbury had told her that it had been so in the bad old heathen days, and the priests had laboured to take down the ringstones and haul them away. She supposed it was because she was a sinful woman that she had this glance into heathendom. Once she had dreamed that she and Lancelot were lying together beneath the ringstones, and he had had of her what she had never given him. Lancelot. He was so good. Never did he press her for more than a Christian woman and a wedded wife could give him without dishonour. Yet it was written that the Christ had said himself, "Whoever looks upon a woman with lust has committed adultery already with her in his heart." So she had sinned with Lancelot, and there was no mitigation. They were both damned. She shivered and turned her eyes away from the tor, for it seemed that Arthur could read her thoughts. He had spoken Lancelot's name.
"Don't you think so, Gwen? It's more than time Lancelot should marry."
She forced her voice to stay calm. "On the day when he asks you for a wife, my lord and my king, you should give him one."
"But he will not ask," Arthur said. "He has no will to leave me. Pellinore's daughter would make him a good wife, and she is your own cousin. Don't you think it would suit? Lancelot isn't rich. Ban had too many bastards to give much to any one of them. It would be a good match for both."
"Aye, no doubt you are right," Guinevere said. "Elaine follows him about with her eyes as the lads in the play-yard do, eager for a kind word or even a look. Though it hurt her heart, perhaps it would be best if Lancelot should marry. He was too good to be tied to a woman who could give him so little. And then she could amend her sin with a firm promise to sin no more, as she could not do when Lancelot was near.
Well, I will speak of it again with Lancelot. He says he has no mind to marry, but I will make him understand it means not exile from my court. Would it not be good for me and mine if our children some day might have Lancelot's sons to follow them?"
"God grant that day may come," said Guinevere, and crossed herself. They stood together at the height, looking out over the summer country which lay spread before them.
"There's a rider on the road," said Arthur,
looking down the road which led toward the castle. Then, as the rider drew nearer,
"It's Kevin the Harper, come here from Avalon. And at least this time he has had sense enough to travel with a serving man."
"That is no serving man," said Guinevere,
her sharp eyes resting on the slender form riding behind Kevin on his horse.
"That is a woman. I'm shocked.
I had thought the Druids were like to priests and stayed far from women." "Why, some of them do, sweetheart. But I have heard from Taliesin that all those who are not in the highest rank may marry, and frequently they do," he said. "Perhaps Kevin has taken him a wife, or perhaps he has only travelled with someone coming this way. Send one of your women to tell Taliesin that he is here, and another to the kitchens. If we shall have music this night, it is only fitting we have something like a feast to celebrate it. Let us walk this way and welcome him. A harper of Kevin's skill is worthy of welcome from the king himself."
By the time they reached the great gates, they had been opened, and Kai himself had stepped forward to welcome the great harper to Camelot. Kevin bowed to the king, but Guinevere's eyes were on the slender, ill-clad form behind. Morgaine bowed and said,
"So, I have returned to your court, my brother."
Arthur went and embraced her.
"Welcome back, my sister.
It has been so long," he said, his cheek lingering against hers.
"And now that our mother has gone from us, we who are kinfolk should be together. Do not go from me again, sister."
She said, "I had no thought of it." Guinevere came and embraced her too, feeling the other woman's body sharp-boned and thin against her arms. She said, "You look as if you had been long on the road, my sister."
"True."
"I have come very far," Morgaine said, and Guinevere kept her hand as they walked within. "Where have you been? You were so long away, almost I thought you would never return," Guinevere said. "Almost I thought so myself," said Morgaine. But Guinevere noticed she didn't say either where she had been. "Such gear as you left with us, your harp, your gowns, all these things, they were left at Carleon. Tomorrow I will send for them as swiftly as a messenger can ride," Guinevere said, as she took her to the room where her women slept. "Till then, if you will, I will lend you a gown." "You have been travelling long, sister, and you look as if you had been sleeping within a cow byre. Were you attacked by robbers and your gear stolen?" "I had ill fortune indeed on the road," Morgaine said. "And if you will send someone to me that I may bathe and dress myself clean, I will bless you. I would ask the loan of a comb, too, and pins for my hair, and a shift." "My gown will be too long for you," said Guinevere, "but no doubt you can pin it up somehow until your own clothes have come. Combs and veils and shifts I will give you gladly, and shoes as well. Those look as if you'd walked in them from here to Lothian and back." She beckoned to one of her waiting women and said, "Bring the red gown, and the veil that goes with it, and a shift, and my other indoor shoes and hose. Choose everything so that my lord's sister is dressed as is fitting to her station. And send for a bath, and a bathwoman too." She looked disdainfully at the gown Morgaine was taking off, and said, "If that one cannot be fitly aired and cleaned, give it to one of the dairy women." When Morgaine appeared at the king's table, she wore the red gown which lent colour to her dark skin and became her well. They besought her to sing, but she would not, saying that as Kevin was at hand, no one would listen to a robin's chirping when a nightingale was near. The next day Kevin sought private audience with Arthur, and he and the king and Taliesin too were closeted for many hours, and even had supper brought to them there. But Guinevere never knew what they spoke of. Arthur told her little of affairs of state. No doubt they were angered with him that he had chosen to renounce his vows to Avalon. But soon or late they must accept it, that he was a Christian king. As for Guinevere, she had other things to think of. That spring there was fever at the court, and some of her women fell sick of it, so that until Easter was past, she had no leisure to think of anything else. She had never thought she would be glad of Morgaine's presence, but Morgaine knew much of herb lore and of healing, and she thought it was due to Morgaine's wisdom that there were no deaths in the court. In the country round, she heard, many died, though mostly little children and old folk. Her little half-sister Isotta took the fever, but her mother heard, and would not have her stay at court, so that she was sent back to the island, and later in that month Guinevere heard that she had died. She mourned for the girl. She had come to be fond of her, and had hoped to marry her to one of Arthur's companions when she was older. Lancelot fell sick of the fever too, and Arthur gave orders that he should be quartered in the castle and nursed by her own women. While there was still danger that she might take the fever, she didn't go near him. She had hoped herself pregnant again, but it turned out not to be so, only her own hopes and illusions. When he began to recover, she went often and sat by his side. Morgaine came too, to play the harp, while he was unable to leave his bed. One day, watching them when they spoke of Avalon, Guinevere caught the look in Morgaine's eyes and thought, why, she still loves him. She knew Arthur still hoped for this, a match between Morgaine and Lancelot, and she watched, sick with jealousy, as Lancelot listened to Morgaine's harp.
Her voice is so sweet.
She isn't beautiful, but she is so wise and learned.
Beautiful women are so many.
Elaine is beautiful, and Melias, and the daughters of King Roynes, and even more Gauze is beautiful. But why should Lancelot care for that?
And she marked the gentleness of Morgaine's hands as she lifted him and gave him her herb medicines and cooling drinks. She, Guinevere, wasn't good at all with the sick. She had no skills. She sat dumb while Morgaine talked and laughed and amused him. It was growing dark, and at last Morgaine said, "I can no longer see the harp strings, and I am hoarse as a crow. I can sing no more. You must drink your medicine, Lancelot, and then I will send your man to you to get you settled for the night." With a wry smile, Lancelot took the cup she put in his hand.
"Your drinks are cooling, kinswoman, but oh, the taste of them."
"Drink it," Morgaine said, laughing. "Arthur has put you under my command when you are sick."
"Aye. And I do not doubt if I refused, you should beat me and put me supperless to bed. Well, if I drink my medicine like a good lad, I shall have a kiss and a honey cake," Lancelot said.
Morgaine chuckled. "You cannot have a honey cake yet. You can have your nice gruel.
But if you drink up your potion, you shall have a good night kiss, and I will bake you a honey cake when you are well enough to eat it."
"Yes, mother,"
Lancelot said, wrinkling up his nose. Guinevere could see that Morgaine didn't like the jest, but when he had emptied the cup, she bent over him and kissed him lightly on the brow, and drew up the covers under his chin as a mother smooths a child's cradle.
"There now, good child, go to sleep," she said, laughing.
But the laughter sounded bitter to Guinevere, and Morgaine went away. Guinevere stood by Lancelot's bed and said,
"She is right, my dear. You should sleep."
"I am weary of Morgaine being always right," said Lancelot. "Sit you here by me for a little, dear love."
It was seldom he dared speak so to her, but she sat herself on his bed and let him hold her hand. After a little he pulled her down beside him and kissed her. She lay along the edge of his bed and let him kiss her again and again. But after a long time he sighed, weary, and didn't protest when she rose from his side.
"My dearest love, this cannot go on like this. You must give me leave to depart from the court."
"What? To chase Pellinore's favourite dragon? Why? What will Pellinore do in holiday time, then?"
"It is his favourite hunting,"
Guinevere said, jesting. But it was like a pain in her heart. He seized both her arms, pulling her down.
"No, make this not a jest, Gwen. You know it, and I know it. And God help us both, I think even Arthur knows it, that I have loved none but you, or ever will, since first I set eyes on you in your father's house. And if I am to remain a true man to my king and my friend, then I must depart from this court and never set eyes on you again."
Guinevere said, "I would not hold you if you feel that you must go."
"As I have gone before," he said violently. "Every time I rode forth to war, half of me longed that I should fall at Saxon hands and return no more to hopeless love. God forgive me, there were times when I hated my king, whom I have sworn to love and serve. And then I thought, no woman should part the friendship that was between us two. And I have sworn I would think of you no more, save as the wife of my king. But now there are no more wars, and I must sit here day by day and look upon you at his side in his high seat, and think of you in his bed, his happy and contented wife."
"Why do you think I am any more happy or contented than you?" she demanded, her voice shaking.
"At least you can choose whether to stay or to go. But I was given into Arthur's hands without even so much as will you or no.
nor can I rise and ride forth from court when things go not to my will, but must stay here within walls and do what is expected of me. If you must go, I cannot say, stay. And if you stay, I cannot say to you, go. At least you are free to go or to stay as makes you happiest.
Do you think there is happiness for me, either in staying or going?
Lancelot demanded. And for a moment she thought that he would weep.
Then he mastered himself and said,
Love, what do you want me to do?
God forbid I should give you more unhappiness. If I am gone from here, then it is your duty plain to be a good wife to Arthur, no more and no less. If I stay here...
He broke off.
If you feel it is your duty to go, she said, then you must go.
And tears flooded down her face, blurring her sight. He said, and his voice was strained as if he had had a mortal wound. Guinevere. He so seldom spoke her formal name. It was always my lady or my queen. Or when he spoke to her in play, it was always Gwen. When he spoke it now, it seemed to her she had never heard a sweeter sound.
Guinevere, why do you weep?
Now she must lie, and lie well, because she could not, in honour, tell him the truth. She said, Because? And stopped.
And then, in a choking voice, she said,
Because I do not know how I shall live if you go away. He swallowed hard and took her hands between his own and said,
Why, then? Why, love? I am not a king, but my father has given me a small estate in Brittany. Would you come with me away from this court?
I know not. Perhaps it would be the more honourable way than stay here at Arthur's court and make love to his wife. He loves me, then, Guinevere thought. He wants me. This is the honourable way. But panic flooded through her. To go forth alone, so far, even with Lancelot. And then the thought of what everyone would say of her, should she be so dishonoured. He lay clasping her hand in his. He said,
We could never return, you know. Never. And it's likely we should be excommunicated, both of us. That would mean little to me. I'm not so much a Christian as all that. But you, my Guinevere.
She put up her veil over her face and wept, knowing what a coward she was.
Guinevere, he said, I would not lead you into sin.
She said bitterly, We have sinned already, you and I.
And if the priests are right, we will be damned for it,
Lancelot said bitterly. And yet have I never had more of you than these kisses.
We have had all the evil and the guilt, and none of the pleasure which is said to come from sin. And I'm not so sure I believe the priests. What sort of god goes about every night like a night watchman, peeping here and prying there like an old village gossip, to see if any man beds with his neighbour's wife?
The Merlin said something like that, Guinevere said, low. And sometimes it seems to me sensible. And then again, I wonder if it is the devil's work to lead me into evil.
Oh, talk not to me of the devil, he said,
and pulled her down beside him again. Sweetheart, my own, I will go away if you want me to, or I will stay, but I cannot bear to see you so unhappy. I don't know what I want, she wept, and let him hold her, sobbing. At last he murmured,
We have paid for the sin already.
And his mouth covered hers. Trembling, Guinevere let herself surrender to the kiss,
his eager hands searching at her breasts. She almost hoped that this time he would not be content with that. But there was a sound in the hallway, and Guinevere drew herself upright in sudden panic. She sat on the edge of the bed as Lancelot's esquire came into the room. He coughed and said,
"My lord, the Lady Morgaine told me you were ready to go to your rest. By your leave, my lady."
"Morgaine again, damn her."
Lancelot laughed and let go of Guinevere's hand.
"Yes, and I doubt it not, my lady is weary. Will you promise to come and see me tomorrow, my queen?"
She was both grateful and angry that his voice sounded so calm. She turned away from the light the serving man carried. She knew her veil was crushed and her dress rumpled, her face smeared with crying and her hair coming down. How she must look! What would the man think they had been doing? She put her veil over her face and rose.
"Good night, Sir Lancelot."
"Kerval, care you well for my king's dear friend," and went out, hoping forlornly that she could get down the hall to her own room before she burst into weeping again.
Ah, God!
How dare I pray to God that I may sin further? I should pray to be free of temptation, and I cannot. Chapter 16. A day or two before Beltane Eve, Kevin the Harper came again to Arthur's court. Morgaine was glad to see him. It had been a long and weary springtime. Lancelot had recovered from the fever and gone north to Lothian, and Morgaine had thought she should ride to Lothian too, to see how it was with her son. But she didn't want to go in Lancelot's company, nor would he have wished for her as a travelling companion. She thought, "My son is well where he is. Another time I will go and see him." Guinevere was sorrowful and silent. In the years Morgaine had been absent, the queen had altered from a light-hearted, childish woman to a silent, thoughtful one, more pious than was reasonable. Morgaine suspected that she pined after Lancelot, and knowing Lancelot, Morgaine thought, with a touch of contempt, that he would neither leave the woman in peace nor lead her wholeheartedly into sin. And Guinevere was a good match for him. She would neither give in to him nor give him up. She wondered what Arthur thought, but it would have taken a braver woman than she to ask him. Morgaine welcomed Kevin to court, and to herself she thought it not unlikely that they would keep Beltane together. The sun tides ran hot in her blood, and if she couldn't have the man she wanted, and she knew it was still Lancelot to whom she was drawn, it might be as well to take a lover who found delight in her. It was good to be cherished and sought after. And, as neither Arthur nor Lancelot would do, Kevin spoke with her freely of affairs of state. She thought, with a moment of bitter regret, had she stayed in Avalon, by now she would be consulted in all the great affairs of her time. Well, it was too late for that. Done was done. So she greeted Kevin in the great hall, and had him served food and wine, a task Guinevere gladly gave over to her. Guinevere liked well enough to hear Kevin play on the harp, but she couldn't bear the sight of him. So Morgaine served him and spoke to him of Avalon.
"Is Vivian well?"
"Well, and still resolved to come to Camelot at Pentecost," said Kevin. "And it is well, for Arthur would scarce listen to me. Though he has promised not to forbid the Beltane fires this year, at least."
"It would do him little good to forbid them," said Morgaine.
"But Arthur has trouble nearer home, too," she gestured. "Beyond that window, almost within sight from the heights of the castle, lies the island kingdom of Leodegrance. Had you heard?" "A chance-come traveller told me he was dead," Kevin said, "and he left no son. His Lady Eleanor died with her last child a few days after his death. The fever was cruel in that country."
"Guinevere wouldn't travel thither for the burying," Morgaine said. "She had little to weep for,
Hers was not a loving father.
Arthur will have consulted her about setting a regent there. He says that now the kingdom is hers, and if they should have a second son, that son shall have it. But it seems not likely now that Guinevere will have even one.
Kevin nodded slowly.
Aye. She miscarried of a child before Mount Baden, and was very ill. Since then I haven't heard even a rumour that she was pregnant, said Kevin. How old is the High Queen?
I think she is at least 25 now, said Morgaine. But she wasn't certain. She had dwelt so long in the fairy country.
That is old for a first child,
said Kevin.
Though I doubt not, like all barren women, she prays for a miracle. What ails the queen that she doesn't conceive?
I am no midwife, said Morgaine.
She seems healthy enough, but she has worn out her knees in prayer, and there is no sign.
Well, the gods will have it as they will, Kevin said. But we will need their mercy on this land if the High King dies with no son. And now there are no threats from the Saxons outside to keep the rival kings of Britain from falling one upon the other and tearing this land to shreds. I never trusted Lot, but he is dead, and Gawain is Arthur's staunchest man, so there is little to fear from Lothian, unless Morgause finds herself a lover with ambition to be High King on his own.
Lancelot has gone there, but he should return quickly, said Morgaine. And Kevin added,
Vivian, too, would ride to Lothian for some reason, though we thought, all of us, that she was too old for such a journey.
Why, then she will see my son.
Morgaine's heart leapt, and there was a tightness like pain or weeping in her throat. Kevin seemed not to see.
I met not with Lancelot on the road, he said. No doubt he took another road, or stayed to greet his mother, or perhaps, he grinned slyly, to keep the Beltane feast. That would give joy to every woman in Lothian if he tarried there. Morgause wouldn't let such a tender morsel escape her clutches.
She is his mother's sister, Morgaine said, and I think Lance is too good a Christian for that. He has courage enough to face the Saxons in battle, but small courage for that battle. Kevin raised his eyebrows.
Oh-ho, is it so? I doubt not you speak from knowledge, he said. But for politeness's sake, we will say it is from the sight. But Morgause would like well to see Arthur's best knight brought low by scandal. Then would Gawain stand nearer to the throne. And the lady is liked well by all men. She's not so old either, but still beautiful. Her hair still red as ever, without a line of grey.
Oh, said Morgaine caustically, they sell henna from Egypt in the markets of Lothian.
And her waist is slim, and they say she practices magic arts to spellbind men to her,
Kevin said.
But this is gossip and no more. I have heard she has ruled well enough in Lothian. Do you dislike her so much, Morgaine?
No. She is my kinswoman, and has been good to me, Morgaine said, and started to say, she fostered my child, and that would open the way to ask if he had heard news of Gwydion. Then she stopped herself. Even to Kevin she could not confess that. She said instead, but I like it not that my kinswoman Morgause should be the common talk of Britain as a bawd.
It isn't as bad as that, Kevin said, laughing,
and put away his wine cup.
If the lady has an eye to handsome men, she wouldn't be the first or last. And now Morgause is widowed, no man can call her to account for who lies in her bed. But I mustn't keep the High King waiting. Wish me fortune, Morgaine, for I must bring ill news to my king. And you know the doom meted of old to him who brought the king news he had no mind to hear.
Arthur is not that sort, said Morgaine. But if it is not a secret, what ill news do you bring?
Not news at all, said Kevin. For it has been said more than once that Avalon will not have it that he rule as a Christian king,
whatever his private faith may be. He shall not allow the priests to put down the worship of the goddess, nor touch the oak groves. And if he does so, then am I to say to him from the lady, the hand which gave him the sacred sword of the Druids can turn it in his hand to smite him.
That will not be pleasant hearing, said Morgaine, but perhaps it will call his oath to mind.
Aye, and Vivien has still one other weapon she can use, said Kevin.
But when Morgaine asked what, he would tell her no more. When he had gone from her, Morgaine sat thinking of the night to come. There would be music at dinner, and later... Well, Kevin was a pleasant lover, gentle and eager to please her, and she was wearied of sleeping alone. She was still sitting in the hall when Kai came to announce that another rider had come.
"A kinsman of yours, Lady Morgaine. Would you greet him and serve him wine?"
Morgaine agreed. Had Lancelot returned so soon already? But the rider was Balin. She hardly knew him at first. He was heavier, so big now that she supposed it must take an oversized horse to carry his weight. But he recognized her at once.
"Morgaine, greetings, kinswoman," he said,
and sat beside her, taking the cup she offered. She told him that Arthur was speaking with Kevin and the Merlin, but would see him at dinner, and asked him for the news.
"Only that a dragon has been sighted again in the north,"
Balin said.
"And no, this is no fantasy like old Pelennor's. I saw the track where it had been, and talked with two of the people who had seen it. They weren't lying, nor telling a tale to amuse or give themselves importance. They were in terror of their lives. They said it had come out of the lake and taken their serving-man. They showed me his shoe."
"His shoe, kinsman?"
"He lost it when he was taken, and I didn't like touching the slime that besmeared it," Balin said. "I'm going to ask Arthur for half a dozen knights to ride with me and put an end to it."
"You must ask Lancelot if he returns," Morgaine said as lightly as she could. "He will need some practice with dragons. I think Arthur is trying to make a match between Lancelot and Pelennor's daughter." Balin looked at her sharply.
"I do not envy the girl who has my little brother for husband," he said. "I have heard his heart is given. Or should I not say?"
"You should not say it," said Morgaine. Balin shrugged.
"So be it. Arthur, then, has no special reason for wishing to find Lancelot a bride well away from court," he said. "I had not heard that you had come back to court, kinswoman. You look well."
"And how is it with your foster brother?"
"Balin is well enough, when last I saw him," said Balin, "though he still has no love for Vivien. Still, there is no reason to believe he bears grudge for our mother's death. He raved and swore revenge then. But he would have to be a madman indeed to think still of such things. In any case, if such was his thought, he spoke not of it when he was here at Pentecost a year ago. That is Arthur's newest custom. You may not know that wherever we may travel in all of Britain, every one of his old companions should gather at Pentecost and dine at his table. At that time, too, he makes new companions in the order of knighthood, and he will accept any petitioner, however humble."
"Yes, I had heard of that," said Morgaine, and a flicker of unease passed over her. Kevin had spoken of Vivien. She told herself it was only disquiet at the idea that a woman of the lady's years might come here as a common petitioner. As Balin said, it would take a madman to harbour thoughts of revenge after all this time. That night there was music, Kevin's fine playing and singing, and later still that night, Morgaine slipped from the chamber where she slept with Guinevere's unwedded ladies as noiselessly as a ghost, or as a priestess trained in Avalon,
and made her way to the chamber where Kevin slept. She left there before daylight, well contented. But one thing Kevin had said, though they had had other things to speak of than Arthur, troubled her mind.
"Arthur wouldn't listen to me," he said. "He told me that the folk of England were a Christian people, and while he wouldn't persecute any man for following what gods he liked, still he would stand with the priests and the church, as they had stood by his throne. And he sent word to the Lady of Avalon that if she would have back the sword, she could come and take it."
Even after she had crept back into her own bed, Morgaine lay wakeful. It was the legendary sword which had bound so many of the tribesmen and northmen to Arthur, and it was his allegiance to Avalon which had bound the dark pre-Roman people. Now, it seemed, Arthur was further from that allegiance than he had ever been. She could speak with him, but no, he wouldn't listen to her. She was a woman and his sister, and always, between them, lay the memory of that morning after the king-making, so that never could they speak freely as they might have done before. And she didn't carry the authority of Avalon. With her own hands had she cast that away. It might be that Vivian could make him see the importance of keeping to his oath. But tell herself this as she would, it was long before Morgaine could close her eyes and sleep. Chapter 17. Even before she rose from her bed, Guinevere could feel the bright sunlight through the bed curtains. Summer is here. And then, Beltane. The very fullness of pagandom. She was sure that many of her serving men and women would be slipping away from the court tonight when the Beltane fires were lighted on Dragon Island in honour of their goddess. There to lie in the fields, some of them, no doubt, to come home again with their wombs quickened with the child of the god. And I, a Christian wife, cannot bear a son to my own dear lord. She turned over in bed and lay watching Arthur's sleep. Oh, yes, he was her dear lord, and she loved him well. He had taken her as part of a dowry and sight unseen, yet he had loved her, cherished her, honoured her. It wasn't her fault that she could not do the first duty of a queen and bear him a son for his kingdom. Lancelot? No. She had sworn to herself, when last he went from court, she would think no more of him. She still hungered for him, heart and soul and body, but she had vowed that she would be a loyal and a faithful wife to Arthur. Never again should Lancelot have from her even these games and toyings, which made them both ache for more. It was playing at sin, even if there was nothing worse. Beltane. Well, perhaps as a Christian woman and queen of a Christian court, it was her duty to make such feastings and play this day as all the people of the court should enjoy without harm to their souls. She knew that Arthur had sent out word of games and arms practice to be held for prizes at Pentecost, as he had done each year since the court came here to Camelot. But there were enough of his people here that some sport could be had this day too. She would offer a silver cup. And there should be harping and dancing, too. And she would do for the women what sometimes they did in play, offer a ribbon for the woman who could spin the most yarn in an hour, or work the largest piece of tapestry. Yes, there should be innocent sport, so that none of her people should regret the forbidden play on Dragon Island. She sat up and began to dress herself. She must go and talk to Kai. But although she busied herself all the morning, and Arthur, when she spoke of it, was pleased, thinking it the best of devices, so that he and Kai spent the morning in talking of the prizes they should offer for the best sword play and horsemanship. Yes, and there should be a prize, perhaps a cloak, for the best among the boys. Still, inside her heart, The thought gnawed. It is the day on which the ancient gods demand that we honour fertility. And I am still barren. And so, an hour before high noon, at which hour the trumpets would be blown to gather men before the arms field to begin their sport, Guinevere sought out Morgaine, yet not quite certain what she would say to her. Morgaine had taken charge of the dyeing room for the wool they spun, and was also in charge of the queen's brew women. She knew how to keep ale from spoiling when it was brewed, and how to distill strong spirit for medicines, and make perfumes of flower petals, which were finer than those brought from over the seas, and more costly than gold. There were some women in the castle who believed this was magic art, but Morgaine said no. It was only that she had been taught about the properties of plants and grains and flowers. Any woman, Morgaine said, could do what she did, if she was neat-handed and willing to take the time and trouble to see to it. Guinevere found her with her holiday gown tied up and her hair covered with a cloth, sniffing at a batch of beer which had spoilt in the vats. "Throw it away," she said. "The balm must have got cold and it has soured. We can start with another batch tomorrow. There is plenty for this day, even with a queen's feasting." Whatever put it into her head? Guinevere asked, "Have you no mind to feasting, sister?" Morgaine turned. "Not truly," she said. "But I marvel that you have, Gwen. I thought on Beltane you would be all for pious fasting and prayer, if only to show you were not one of those who made merry in honour of the goddess of the crops and fields." Guinevere coloured. She never knew if Morgaine was making fun of her. Perhaps God has ordained it, that people should make merry in honour of the coming of the summer, and there is no need to speak of the goddess. "Oh, I know not what I think. Believe you that the goddess gives life to crops and fields, and the wombs of ewes and heifers and women?" "I was so taught in Avalon, Gwen. Why do you ask this now?" Morgaine took off the headcloth with which she had covered her hair, and Guinevere thought suddenly that Morgaine was beautiful. Morgaine was older than Guinevere. She must be past 30. But she looked no older than when Guinevere had first seen her. It was no wonder all men thought her a sorceress. She wore a fine-spun gown of dark blue wool, very plain, but coloured ribbons were braided into her dark hair, which was looped about her ears and fastened with a gold pin. Next to her, Guinevere felt dull as a hen, a simple, home-keeping woman, even though she was High Queen of Britain, and Morgaine only a heathen duchess. Morgaine knew so much, and she herself was so unlearned. She could do no more than write her name and read a little in her gospel book, while Morgaine was skilled in all the clerkly arts. She could read and write, and yes, she knew the housewifely arts too. She could spin and weave and do fine embroideries, and dyeing and brewing. Yes, and herb lore and magic as well. At last Guinevere faltered. "My sister, they have said it as a jest, but is it true that you know all manner of charms and spells for fertility? I cannot live with it any longer, that every lady at court watches every morsel I eat to see if I am breeding, or takes note of how tight I tie my girdle. Morgaine, if indeed you know these charms they say you know, my sister, I beg you, will you use those arts for me?" Moved and troubled, Morgaine laid a hand on Guinevere's arm. "In Avalon, it is true, it is said that such and such things can help if a woman does not bear when she should. But Guinevere..." She hesitated, and Guinevere felt her face flooding with shame. At last Morgaine went on, "I am not the goddess. It may be that it is her will that you and Arthur should have no children.
Would you really try to turn the will of God with spells and charms?